from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. To be young in India today is in some ways a wonderful thing. The opportunities are greater now than they ever have been, but that's not the whole story. New York Times journalist Somini Sengupta returns to the country of her birth as a journalist and also a mother and finds pervasive corruption, ethnic and gender discrimination, a lousy educational system, and nowhere near enough jobs for the 10 million people who become adults every year in India. The book is The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young, and we'll be talking with the author in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. For millennia, Indians born into lower castes have accepted their lot in life as a form of karma, punishment for misdeeds in past lives. That's changing. But for all the promise of living in a democracy, equality is nowhere to be found in India. So Somini Sengupta writes in her new book, The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. She's here with us in studio now. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, what a fabulous book. I really enjoyed reading it. I'm wondering, what inspired you to take this project on?
Thank you. Thank you so much for reading it. I am a daughter of India. My daughter is a daughter of India. And I wanted to better understand the country that made me. I wanted to better understand the country that made her and really try to imagine what kind of a future the country might have. So it was a personal exploration, but also I wanted to write it for a much broader audience because, you know, you want to see the future. The future is India because it is not only going to be the most populous country in the world in a few years, it is already the youngest country in the world. And what I mean by that is that it's the largest concentration of young people anywhere in the world at any time. The numbers are just extraordinary, Rachel. So right now, the number of Indians who are between the ages of 15 and 34 exceed 420 million. That's more than the combined population of the United States, Canada, and Britain. It's just a staggering number. And every single month, 1 million Indians, they turn 18. They come of age. They can register to vote. They go out looking for jobs. They speak out. They embrace the internet, many of them, for the first time. And their demands are really reshaping Indian democracy. And that's what I really set out to explore.
Now, this describes a country that has moved on in many, many ways from the country your parents left when they left India with you as a child. I imagine growing up in that household, you had ideas about India that were entirely upended by writing this book.
In some ways, yes, because I think the experience of so many immigrants is today to have a real connection, you know, with the land that we left behind, but also to be really nostalgic of the time and place that we left behind. And so while my parents would take me back as a child, like every three or four summers we went back, I never really lost a connection to India. But I was, of course, like very protected, you know, in the cocoon of my family. And there were very few places that I could go. And when I went back to live there as a grown-up and as a journalist, it was an incredibly eye-opening experience, but also such a blessing to be able to really go anywhere and everywhere and step into the lives of so many different kinds of Indians, men and women, young and old, who just let me into their lives. So I am always very mindful of what a gift it is to be a reporter out in the world and to be allowed into people's homes and to allow into people's lives and just ask a bunch of questions, you know?
What would you say was that first moment in New Delhi, was it, where you realized, wow, I'm not at my parents' kitchen table anymore. This is a different country, a different situation. It requires a different part of myself to respond to it.
Yeah, I mean, New Delhi was not a city that I knew. I had never lived there. I barely spoke, you know, a smattering of Hindi when I got there. My Bengali is pretty good. My Hindi certainly was not and still is not. And, you know, it's the experience of so many Americans. It's only when you go overseas that you really recognize that you're an American. I have to say that one thing that really, really struck me, not just that this country was so young, but also that the young were really trying to overcome their past. And that's what I try to signal with the title, The End of Karma. They were born with one destiny. They're trying to make another. And I'm really wary of making vast generalizations, you know, about a country of 1.2 billion people. How can you? Nevertheless, if there's one thing that really struck out, that really struck me, it was just this notion that the ambitions of ordinary young men and women were so very high, their expectations were so very high. And while this is a fantastic thing, it also creates enormous challenges for the country and for the society. And this is kind of what I wanted to explore through the lives of ordinary young people.
You call India a democracy that makes promises it has no intention of keeping. I think that description would probably be true for most democracies in the world. But then you go on to describe in this book so many ways in which ethnic differences, religious differences, gender differences really constrict the opportunities of young people in India in really depressing ways.
So I'll just tell you a story of one woman who I write about in the book. Her name is Varsha. She is the daughter of a presswala. Now, a presswala is someone who has a business in a residential neighborhood. It's usually just a little table set up in the shade of a tree, and she or he presses clothes. And this was Varsha's family's business. For generations, they've been washing and pressing other people's clothes. And Varsha certainly did not want to be a presswala. She did not want to be a presswala's wife. She wanted to be a police officer. This was her ambition. And she wanted to be a police officer because violence against women was just animating her country in the years that she was growing up. And while Varsha had opportunities that her mother certainly did not, she had a school to go to. She was very serious about school. Her parents were supportive of her going to school. But her ambition of becoming a police officer, that was another matter. And Varsha's father was very wary of her being, in uniform, working police officer shifts at all hours of day or night. He couldn't imagine how he was going to find, you know, a good family for her to marry into if she was going to be a cop. And so,
might she not marry into a cop family?
Well, she could, I suppose, yes. But you know, her father was, of course, her champion. Really wanted her to do well, did not want her to be a dhobi's wife, a presswala's wife, or a presswala. But he was very wary of her ambition to be a police officer. And so Varsha's story is so representative of so many young women who, you know, they advance, they push, they nudge their parents to be able to do what they want to do. And yet their parents, and in this case, particularly Varsha's father, you know, remained the enforcer of the very rules that circumscribe her life's chances. And so I thought Varsha was really like so many young people who I met, ambitious, full of aspiration, but thwarted at every step.
Have you kept in touch with Varsha? Do you know, did she make it to police academy?
I'm not going to give away her full story. Her story is still in the writing. She's only 19 years old. And she's still trying to push and nudge and push and nudge her father every step of the way.
You know, unlike in China, India has never been able to suppress content on the internet. It's a big democratic forum for expression. I'm curious if you can sort of describe what the scene is like, for instance, on Facebook in India.
India is one of the fastest growing markets for internet companies. It's a very important market. And as you will have noticed in the last few months, a number of internet companies, particularly Facebook, have really tried to, go after the Indian market. Now, two issues. India has always struggled with freedom of expression. This has always been a real balancing act for India. It has in its constitution a guaranteed a right to free speech. That is one of the foundational elements of the Indian constitution, just as it is in ours. On the other hand, India is made up of so many different religious groups, ethnic groups, caste groups, that it's always had to be very wary that something someone writes or says or paints will upset members of a community so much that there will be unrest on the streets and law enforcement will be unable to contain it. So this delicate balancing act between, on the one hand, ensuring the right to free expression, on the other hand, containing unrest, has been something that India has contended with from the very beginning. So it's got a storied record of banning books by all kinds of governments. But by all measures, the rise of the internet has just sharpened this challenge because posts online can spread very, very quickly, and the government has been very wary. I should add, both the Congress ruled government of the past, but also the one that's in power now, the Bharatiya Janata Party. And so I write in my book about a young woman who didn't really worry about any of this stuff. She wasn't so concerned about politics or the Constitution, but she was on Facebook one day and she was clicking likes on her friend's posts. And it was a fairly innocuous post that was about the funeral procession of a very prominent political leader that shut down the city of Mumbai a few years ago. She commented on it on the day of the funeral procession, and this led to her arrest. Under a provision of the law, a fairly new law at that time, that made it illegal, that made it a criminal offense to say something online that could spark unrest.
What
offline.
Did she say?
She was absolutely terrified. She had never imagined this in her wildest dreams. She had to go to the police station. She had to write an apology. She said, you know, I'd never seen the inside of a police station. You know, this was beyond her wildest dreams.
What was the comment that so offended, and why?
It was a comment about the city being shut down about for the death of this politician. And she told me later that she just she felt bad for the people who were deprived of their livelihood on that day, because there are a lot of people who are merchants. They sell things on the street. And so it was not a very well thought out comment. Perhaps it was her own point of view. And so she was arrested, but I think the story was all the more significant because her arrest infuriated Indians, and especially young Indians, who really rallied by her side and spoke out in defense of free expression. The law under which she was arrested was ultimately thrown out by the Indian Supreme Court last year. And the Supreme Court said there must be the right to free speech in the Constitution must be respected unless there is an imminent risk of violence.
And yet the government and the police would probably say there's always an imminent risk of violence.
Well, but this is a law and order issue. You know, that for law enforcement, the question is, you know, can they prevent lawbreakers from, from creating havoc on the streets? The other thing I want to say about the internet is not just the government's challenge on free expression. This, by the way, is a challenge that many other democracies now face. And you will recall that a couple of years ago, it was shortly after the Charlie Hebdo attack, that France faced this issue about what kind of speech could be allowed on the internet, and arrested someone arrested a French citizen for something that he said on Facebook, too. The other issue that I think is very that is worth watching right now in India is the degree to which Indians are really agitating and clamoring for a free and open internet. Facebook, for several months, made a play to offer something called Facebook Free Basics to India, and it did across the developing world. And Indians really mobilized against that, and said, actually, we don't want just the free basics, the walled garden of the internet that Facebook is going to offer us for free. We want a free and open internet. So this was one of the most crucial battles for net neutrality that we have seen anywhere in the world. And I say watch this space. I think India is going to be a really important country where battles of net neutrality, internet freedom are going to play out in the next several years.
And yet there's this vast gap that you depict so well in this book between the ideal and the actual, a place where so many people in India have no access to the internet or have very limited access to it because of poverty, because of where they are in the country, if they're rural versus urban, because of education. I don't know. I see a lot of the U.S. here, but just in a more extreme fashion, where people want what's gold plated, but don't even have the basic tin cup.
That's a very good point. Internet access is still the province of a minority of Indians. The majority of Indians still are not connected to the internet, but this is precisely why it's so important for American internet companies. This is a fast-growing market. 300 million Indians still don't have electricity, by the way. But the point that you make about promise and reality, I think, is really, really perceptive, because India is a democracy just as we are a democracy. And democracies have these identity crises. That is what makes us democracies. We are not flat authoritarian states. And so in this country, the radical promises of our Constitution are still being fought over. I mean, what is Black Lives Matter if not trying to hold true to the promise of the Constitution, which guarantees, an equality under the eyes of the law, equality of opportunity? So absolutely, we are still dealing with that. What is this presidential election, if not a fundamental identity crisis about what kind of a country we want to be? Similarly, Indians are also very actively negotiating what kind of a country it wants to be. Because like our own country, we were, chattel slavery is part of our history. It's part of our foundational history. The caste system is part of India's foundational history. And both of our constitutions, make this radical promise, equality in the eyes of the law. And so I think for both of our countries, we are on this path, different but really parallel, to hold true to the promise of freedom.
I think for many Indians, the idea of equality under the law for women as well as men is a dearly held principle. But then it seems fairly clear that for many other Indians, it is not. And some of the most horrendous headlines we've seen coming out of India have had to do with gang rapes and then the response to those afterwards. What can you tell us after the research that you did, being in New Delhi and writing this book, about where that conversation is going?
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the most profound and one of the most difficult issues, right, for me to get my head around, because I'm, as I said, I'm a daughter of India. My daughter is a daughter of India. And so this question of how girls and women are treated is personal for me. Now, there is no evidence that, A, violence against women in India is growing. There is no evidence that violence against women in India is greater or less than other parts of the world. These are hard things to measure, but I certainly did not find any evidence for either of these things. What I did find, and this I think is extraordinary, what I did find is that women are not keeping quiet anymore when they are harassed or assaulted or raped, whether that's in the home by family members. And by the way, as in our own country, the vast majority of assaulters are people who are known to the survivor. So women are not keeping quiet about it, whether it's a person in their home, in the workplace, or on the streets. And the gang rape in December 2012 that became widely known across the world, that shaped Varsha's coming of age, as I described, that really triggered enormous fury among young Indians. Men and women, I have to say, there were lots of men on the streets who were also agitating for just basic safety and basic respect for women. So I think that there's a really that was a very important tipping point where young women and men said, enough is enough.
You know, I'm wondering if you can talk about the hope in the book title. It is called Hope and Fury Among India's Young. What makes you hopeful?
Oh, I mean, the seven young people who I talk about, pretty much all of them fill me with enormous hope because they are people with incredible determination and resilience, you know, who are really, some of them are fighting against all odds. Varsha's simple ambition to support herself, you know, to stand on her own feet is remarkable. It takes incredible grit. It takes incredible resilience and fire in the belly. And honestly, I don't think that I would have that kind of fire in the belly. You know, I don't think I could stand up and compete against some of these folks. So there's such a well of talent and grit and determination among young Indians. And I just can't help but think that for them to realize their true potential and for India to realize its true potential, I think that some basic equality of opportunity would be welcome. And that's precisely what they are clamoring for.
We're talking with New York Times journalist Somini Sengupta about her new book, The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. What questions do you have for her and about India today? If you're from India or have family there, we'd love to hear you call in and share your perspective. 866-733-6786. And you know I like to give that number twice at least. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or tweet to us at KQED Forum. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the young and the restless in India today with New York Times journalist Somini Sengupta, who has written a new book called The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. You know, Somini, we were talking just now about the fact that there has been such a huge influx of especially South Indians to Silicon Valley today. And it's fascinating to watch the cultural interchange across the Pacific. As a reporter, I'm working right now on a story about a group in the South Bay that is has for 30 years been championing Carnatic music. But thanks to technology, thanks to the critical mass of population, you're seeing things like folks studying via Skype with masters in India and then students performing here in the South Bay and then bringing the masters over from the South Bay. It's a very exciting time to see that kind of trans-Pacific communication.
So here's something that many of your listeners may identify with. One of the young men I write about, he's the son of an auto rickshaw driver in Patna, a very tough town in North India. And his single-minded ambition when I first met him was to get into the Indian Institutes of Technology, the IITs, which are some of the toughest universities to get into. And of course, the IITs were created like right after independence by the founding Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru to create a, you know, modern technocratic elite that would build the country, that would build the modern nation. I'm not sure that he imagined how much IIT graduates would fertilize Silicon Valley. I mean, I think there are in every company, in every major company, some really standout graduates of the IITs. And yes, you're absolutely right. I think that Indian Americans, particularly in California, but elsewhere in the country, have really led to a thriving cultural scene where some of the best practitioners of Indian classical dance and music are based here. And, you know, it's remarkable to see because, you know, for our children who are growing up here, I think they now have access to just great traditions of Indian classical music and the arts here.
I also wonder, though, I mean, obviously, Silicon Valley is drawing the world's best from all over the world, right? If you walk through a farmer's market in Palo Alto, you will hear French, German, you know, languages I can't even identify, right?
Probably a lot of Russian.
A lot of Russian as well. And, you know, but at the same time, I think it does also reflect the fact that there's some frustration with the economic opportunities available back in India, that so many people are here. You do hear stories about people going back and starting up companies or taking positions in various subsidiaries in India. There is a lot of cross-pollination economically between the two countries. But I wonder whether India can produce enough jobs for its best and brightest.
So we're living in this kind of historic, unique moment. The shape of the world has never quite been like this. And by that, I mean the rich parts of the world are aging. There are many poor and middle-income countries, India included, that are going through this youth bulge, right? Not just that there are a lot of children. In fact, India's fertility rate has really sharply declined since independence. So there are fewer young children, fewer young kids in the share of the population. The elderly are still a small fraction of the population. And what you have is this incredible youth bulge. You see that in several countries around the world, but India is by far the biggest concentration. And so, look, naturally, there is going to be migration, not just from India, but when you have a global generation gap like this, migration is inevitable. And it will be some of the most talented people, some of the most ambitious people who will want to cross the ocean and go places. And I must say that, you know, age does determine to a large degree the destiny of a country. And so look at China. China is aging faster than it is getting rich because of its one-child policy. It now has a very fast-rising number of elderly people and very few young working-age people to take care of them. So in every family, there might be one working-age adult to take care of, you know, two elderly parents plus children. So China was kind of hurtling towards this demographic cliff and was forced to change its one-child policy. Europe, aging incredibly fast, particularly countries like Germany, where the median age is something like 47. Japan's population is declining because it is aging so fast. Migration is still a source of great tension, right? In some of these countries, in Europe and in Japan, these are not countries that have historically been as open to foreigners. And yes, while migration and the global movement of people may be inevitable, this cannot be, by any means, a solution for young people in those youth bulge countries. So India countries in the Middle East and in the next decades, countries in Africa, which are still very young, absolutely have to create those economic opportunities for the young. And in all of these countries that we've just mentioned, you are having higher rates of education. You know, people are getting more educated. They are connected to the world. They know what's out there. Their ambitions are high, which is a good thing. Which is a good thing. But the economic opportunities must be there. And this is not so easy. I mean, at a time when, you know, the global economy is more and more automated, in the age of 3D printers and where robotics is so important, even in manufacturing, this challenge of creating meaningful jobs is a very real one and a staggering one for countries like India.
Well, let's go to the phones now and Mona in Pleasanton.
Hey, thank you so many. Thank you. My story is I grew up in the U.S. and was living in the Southeast. And my son, at ninth grader, decided he wanted to finish up high school in India. So we packed up the whole family, moved to Bangalore. And my husband set up a new business here and everything, and in the internet business again. And but the thing is that this child ended up loving India so much because it is what he said, it's vibrant. It's growing. There's so much going on. I mean, yes, you see the poverty. You see, you know, a lot of stuff going on there that you just can't explain. But in himself, he grew. He grew to an individual, a young man, that just his whole perspective on life changed. And now he's in college in the U.S., but his whole thing is, I want to go back to India. I want to go travel the world. I want to live in the world. And, you know, they want to grow the economy of India. And we still have our business in India, and we also have our business here. But this is what new India is happening, is a lot of young people are going back and creating situations and opportunities for others. So I really hope this continues, you know. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book. And thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments, Mona. That sounds like exactly what we're talking about, that trans-Pacific communication is just so generative, culturally speaking, economically speaking. Let's go now to Katie in Menlo Park.
Hi. I'm wondering, so I went to India last year. I was visiting my brother, who is living in Uttar Pradesh. And one thing that I really struggled with was, you know, to what extent when we look at institutions that, according to an American worldview, seem unjust, like the vestiges of the caste system, do we need to kind of approach them with a sort of religious and cultural open-mindedness or tolerance and recognize that, you know, we can't use exactly that same worldview? Or can we say that, no, these institutions are unjust and they're oppressive and they divide people? How do you balance those two things in India or anywhere?
Tough question.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question. Look, far be it for me, as an American journalist, to tell anyone, you know, how to view the world. But I must say that the idea of the caste system is something that Indians have been engaging with since the very foundation of modern India. The chief architect of the Constitution, B.R. Ambedkar, wrote very presciently about the caste system. Gandhi, of course, you know, struggled mightily in his own way. And remember, it is illegal to practice untouchability in India. That is illegal, according to the law. So this is not something that is a kind of West versus East thing. This is something that Indians have been contending with in both state, you know, in the law and in social practice.
Very interesting. Thank you so much for that question, Katie. Let's move now to Rika in Fremont.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And it's a great conversation. And you truly said it. We are in the edge of, you know, living that moment of shift and change. I just want to hear your comments around, I know we are at the age of a lot of innovation, technology boom, and, you know, a lot of growth. But for me, I believe that we bring in a lot of rich cultural traditions, and that's what we stand for. What do you think the generation, where is the generation taking in terms of maintaining that rich traditional cultural values that we should take on to new generations? Where is the youth going in that area?
You know, India has this remarkable way of always melding tradition with the modern. You know, it's not a zero-sum game in any ways. And certainly traditions, whether they're cultural traditions, musical traditions, religious traditions, I don't see any of that under great threat. I mean, you know, they're not as fragile as we might make it. They're thriving both among Indians in this country, as we've just said, but also in India.
You've had to do a lot of politically focused reporting for The New York Times, but I'm curious if you saw anything on your travels that where you can sort of give us a heads up. This is a fun cultural thing that's happening. Keep an eye out for it. You'll hear more about it.
Oh, that's such a great question. I mean, where do you start? I think, you know, Indian contemporary art is absolutely blossoming. It has been for some time. That's a great place to watch. I do think that, you know, in terms of sort of innovation, the caller earlier alluded to that. I do think from India will have to come, will inevitably come, innovations that will affect the rest of us. Because remember, because of these staggering numbers, when you have such a not just a large population, but such a large young population, they will impact everything for the rest of us, from our efforts to address global poverty, to our efforts to deal with global health pandemics, to addressing climate change. On all of these issues, India will have to be a leader, strictly, you know, just because of the numbers. And I do hope that among some of these super, you know, smart and innovative young people, there will be some great solutions, particularly on addressing climate change. This is a huge challenge for India.
Thank you so much for that, Rika. Let's go now to Sanjay in Fremont.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question with regards to rape and violence against women. And I wanted to figure out how to improve the situation, but understand how three things compare, say, in India versus the USA. One is, are the laws on paper for rape against women in the US and India roughly similar, or is India 5-10 years behind? Second one is, if somebody does come forward and the case goes to court, what is kind of the and the person is guilty? What's the what's the chance of somebody actually getting prosecuted in, say, U.S. versus India? And the last kind of related thing is, when you look at large organizations, do they turn a blind eye, or if the person is powerful, do they turn a blind eye? Like, for example, in the U.S., you see at universities who turn a blind eye to college rape, or if you see military and the church. When the person is powerful, they kind of tend to, you know, put it under the rug. I want to see how that compares between India and the U.S. And is it just that India is a few years behind, or is there something dramatically wrong that is happening over there?
Thanks so much, Sanjay. Wow, a multi-part question. But he's basically getting at how organizations of authority respond.
Yeah. That's a great question.
Yeah, to
sexual
violence.
And the parallels that you raise with the U.S., I think it's fantastic, because it's not like, you know, sexual assault on college campuses is like a brand new thing. But we're certainly hearing much more about it now. College administrators are under much more pressure than they ever have been. The whole issue of sexual assault in the military, you know, it's about time that it's being spoken of openly. As for India, the December 2012 gang rape, in addition to sparking protest on the street, it did change the law in some important respects. And they're too sort of detailed to get into now, but the law was tightened in many respects, modernized in some ways. On the question of prosecution, look, it requires two things, right? One, women need to be able to come forward to their local police stations, and they need to be able to file a police report. And that is often a very uncomfortable thing, A, because there are not enough women police officers, and I think that some cities and states are making an effort to recruit more police officers, and B, because they're afraid of being, you know, harassed again or questioned about, you know, what they were wearing and where they were and that sort of thing. So that's like at the ground level. You know, do you feel comfortable filing a case? There's also relatedly the question of corruption. It's often the case just to file a police report, and I've heard this repeatedly, filing a police report often means greasing someone's palm. Not always, but sometimes. So this doesn't apply to sexual violence only. It applies to all kinds of crimes. But on the issue of the courts, it is still a very slow process. So the court system sometimes moves, you know, as slow as molasses. And so not just with respect to sexual violence, but with respect to, you know, other crimes. So I write, for instance, about the killing of a couple. They were killed by family members for marrying across caste lines. It was a case of so-called honor killing. And that case, 5 years after the incident, has really not moved. The trial is still pending. So the courts are very much backlogged. Cases move incredibly slowly. And when, you know, justice is not swift, it's very painful. And I think it leaves a lot of questions, you know, in a lot of people's minds.
It's interesting you mention cross-caste marriage. Gerald emails, he's African-American. Can the author speak to how the future of India's young people will be affected by the preference for lighter-skinned people in marriage? I've been to India and read the adverts for marriage, and they specify that the person not be too dark.
Yeah, I mean, there is a there is a long-standing preference for light skin. However, the more remarkable thing is that there are now women, and celebrity women, who have really taken a stand against that, and you know, been celebrating skin of all shades. And I have to say, the whole debate that we're having in our own country about the Nina Simone movie. You know, Nina Simone very much was a model of she was a great proponent of negritude and a great proponent of celebrating women of all hues, including her own. And so with a light-skinned actor being chosen to portray her in this film, that's kicked up a great debate here in our public culture, you know, about whether that's appropriate or not.
Emma in Berkeley writes, your guest has not addressed a major issue currently facing Indian society, the rise of Hindu nationalism through the ruling BJP party, which seeks to perpetuate the caste system and has fueled strident anti-Muslim policies and violence. How are the youth dealing with this?
That's an excellent question. I think that, again, from the beginning of modern India, there has been a tension between these two different paradigms. You know, is India going to be a Hindu country, or is it going to be a secular country where all faiths are able to practice their religion freely? India has chosen the latter path. The Constitution very much guarantees freedom of religion. It is a secular country at its core. It doesn't mean that, you know, people are not religious. It's a deeply religious society. Now, at several moments in modern India's history, you've seen the rise of Hindu nationalism. The A very famous moment came in 1992 when the Bharatiya Janata Party was really propelled to political office in the early 90s and rode a wave of Hindu nationalist sentiment. I write about that in the book. Then Mr. Modi was elected by a very, very wide margin in the summer of 2014, and that really was another major turning point in the political history of modern India, where the Bharatiya Janata Party won so many votes in the national parliamentary elections that it did not have to rule in coalition with any other political parties. It rules as a single party today. Now, Mr. Modi in particular has a checkered past. His own role in failing to stem the religious violence in Gujarat a decade ago has been very much talked about. It was talked about in the election campaign in 2014. He certainly was loath to talk about it himself, but others certainly did. And that is a very well-known part of his history. Now, he faces a really serious challenge now of assuring Indians of all faiths, of all persuasions, that they will be treated equally in the eyes of the law. And there have been some incidents that have given many Indians pause, including Indians, by the way, who supported Mr. Modi. And I'm talking about incidents where, Muslim citizens have been assaulted and beaten to death by a lynch mob in Uttar Pradesh a few months ago on suspicion of slaughtering cattle, which is illegal in Uttar Pradesh. Now, if a law is broken in a law-abiding society, one would expect, and this has been pointed out to me repeatedly by Indians, that's a matter for law enforcement. And so when a lynch mob takes the law into their own hands, I think that gives many Indians, including supporters of Mr. Modi, great pause. And I have to say, he faces a political challenge not only in the next parliamentary elections, which will come in a few years, but his party faces key state elections in the next couple of years. It's already been roundly defeated in major state elections in Delhi, in Bihar. The Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, has been booted. And there are some key elections coming up in the next year or so. And that'll tell you how Indians are feeling about his party.
Let's go now to Raj in Dublin.
Hello, good morning. Great topic and awesome discussion by so many. Thank you so much. I will definitely buy this book. And I was just telling the screener that it's 26 years this April for me. And America was a kind of a girlfriend. I fell in love with America when I was a child. And every time I go now, I can see the change in economy, the change in the youngsters' brilliance, the education reaching out to each and everybody if they want to. Colleges are really, if somebody wants to go to colleges, it's affordable. And I take my son there now, and he is born here. And when I took him there, he started making something now that the bags or, the leather bags or the clothing. And he wanted to reach out to the artisan, the person who's really making it. And he just started a business there, and he felt really, great people, but they're not getting what they have to get. There's a lot of middlemen in between, and he was really enthused about it. And the other story was recently Chennai had a huge flood, and the recent huge flood there, and what happened in Chennai was amazing. There was everybody. There were Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Catholics, Jews, everybody joined together and helped the whole community come up. And it was really eye-opening. And when I went there in December this year, after the flood, I could see that people are people. There is big change there. And I think there's a big future for youngsters in India. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for those comments, Raj. Oh, yes. You want to comment?
Well, I think that the Chennai floods were important in the sense that they are something of a signal of some of the environmental challenges that are coming up. India is susceptible and has been susceptible to extreme climate events, as they're known. So there were these the torrential rains and floods in Uttarakhand a few years ago in northern India in the mountains, where the mountains just literally washed down. There has been a lot of deforestation in those regions. In Chennai, it is a city that has grown very fast. And like many cities, the kind of natural lakes and water bodies, the natural sponges that are in most Indian cities have been developed, sometimes illegally. Meanwhile, in a vast midsection of India this year, there has been really crippling droughts. And this is part of what India will have to really figure out how to handle, are these extreme climate events and the ravages of the environment. And I have to say, there are remarkable people all over India who are doing incredible things in their local communities to deal with climate change and the ravages of the environment, bringing back old water harvesting techniques, doing reforestation, planting crops that are resistant, that hold up to the drought. So I think, again, it's a place to really watch for innovation.
A great thoughtful note to end on. Somini Sengupta, you are speaking at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley tonight at 7:30, I take it?
Yes, thank you.
So that's a clue for local listeners. You can always check out, no matter where you're located, her new book, The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young, again by author Somini Sengupta. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Suki Lewis, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. I'm Rachel Miro. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.